I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. We begin in Syria. The international community is stepping up its involvement there. Leaders of the G8 countries just wrapped up a meeting in Northern Ireland, and they called for political talks to end the violence in Syria. Meanwhile, the White House has announced it will provide arms to rebel forces there. But a new poll from the Pew Research Center says most Americans don't agree with the president's decision to increase American involvement in the Syrian conflict. For more on the situation there and America's involvement, we turn to Shadi Hamid. He's the director of research for the Brookings Doha Center and a former State Department program specialist. He joins us via Skype from Doha in Qatar. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let me ask you the most basic question first, which is who is winning the war there?
Well, right now, the Assad regime has the real advantage on the ground. They've gained a lot of momentum in recent months. They retook the strategically important town of Qusair, and they also have more and more support from Hezbollah and Iran. So it's very clear here that the regime is not backing down. They're as confident as ever, and they're hoping to push their advantage. And that puts the rebels, obviously, in a very precarious situation. And the rebels are probably at their weakest today compared to really any other time in the past year, I would say.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, if you talk to those in the Syrian opposition, you'll hear one thing over and over, that they've been waiting for more advanced weapons. They've been waiting even for ammunition. You actually have a situation where rebel commanders on the ground are complaining that they don't have enough bullets and that the international community has essentially ignored them or betrayed them altogether by not stepping up, by not providing more support. And the Syrian opposition, as well as the rebel forces, have been calling for the last year and a half for direct military intervention, whether in the form of a no-fly zone, surgical airstrikes against the Assad regime and its military assets. They've been asking for a lot of things, and none of it has really come. And they're facing an army which has much more people and has much more advanced weapons, artillery, aircraft, you name it. It's a very big gap in equipment.
Well, let's talk about how America may or may not get involved. You wrote a piece for The Atlantic earlier this week that said President Obama's Syrian policy doesn't make sense because arming the rebels will probably not make a difference in the conflict. Why do you say that?
Well, so the U.S. is only committed to giving small arms to the Syrian rebels. The Syrian rebels have been demanding not just small arms, but also the kind of advanced weaponry that will help them, you know, face the Syrian army, whether it's anti-aircraft weapons, whether it's man pads, but none of those advanced weapons are forthcoming. And in any case, the regime is in a better position now. So to actually regain the advantage, equipment is a start, but it's not enough. There has to be an answer to the question of where do we go from here? So how do we get the rebels in a much stronger position to the point where they can gain more territory and where the Assad regime has actually a risk of losing or being pushed back even in Damascus? So for those things to happen, there's no sense that small arms are going to do it. The reason that the Obama administration did this is because they need to be seen as doing something, that there was a real sense that the U.S. was not leading, that the U.S. wasn't providing any solutions. There was no progress on the ground. So the easiest thing that you can propose is providing arms, some arms, to the rebels.
What is the argument for the United States to become more involved? Shadi, if we look back through history, the periods of time in which the United States has trained rebels in civil conflicts, it hasn't generally gone well for us. That's true in Afghanistan, where al-Qaeda may have risen from the ranks of the Mujahideen that the United States armed and trained. And look in Mexico, the very military personnel that we trained there, many of them became part of the Zetas cartel and is probably causing a problem for both us and the Mexican government. So why would we want to take the same risk again?
Well, I mean, you can also look at other examples such as Libya in 2011, which I consider to be a success for the simple reason that the rebels did defeat the Gaddafi regime. And we can also look at Bosnia and Kosovo, where no-fly zones and airstrikes actually defeated the regimes in question. And again, averted genocide and mass slaughter. Yes, there are risks in arming rebels, and we don't know who in the end these arms will end up with. These are all valid concerns, and no one's arguing that intervention is perfect or easy. But we have to look at the available options, and those against intervention have not proposed a viable course of action. And we've tried their way for the last 2 years, but we can see how disastrous the results have been over 2 years. We're talking about 93,000 Syrians killed. We're talking about millions of internally displaced and refugees. We're talking about the rise of radicals. So it's common sense, in my view, that if a certain policy has been failing for 2 years, we have to consider an alternative, even though it's not an ideal option. So we have to ask ourselves, when is enough enough?
If you're just joining us, we're talking about America's new involvement in Syria with Shadi Hamid. He's the director of the Brookings Doha Center. It sounds, Shadi, like you're making the humanitarian argument solely. Is there a strategic reason why the United States would want to get involved in Syria?
Well, that's a distinctive thing about the Syrian crisis, is that there's a very strong humanitarian rationale. There's also a strong strategic case to be made that Iran is obviously an adversary of the U.S., and they have long used Syria as an entry point, and that's a key focal point of their influence in the region. The same goes with Hezbollah, which is on the U.S. terrorist list. So if we're talking about shifting the balance of power and weakening Iran and Hezbollah, these are things that will be accomplished by military intervention as well. I don't think that should be the emphasis. I see this primarily as a humanitarian issue. But if people want to talk about the strategic implications, that's important to keep in mind. There's also the issue that this is destabilizing the whole region, whether it's Iraq, Lebanon, Jordan. And so it's not as if this is it's contained within Syria's borders. It's spreading and it's having very serious effects. And we can also talk about the rise of Al-Qaeda and the rise of radical groups among the rebels. If we had intervened a year and a half ago, things would have been different because the radicals weren't as strong then as they are today. But by not intervening and not trying to shorten the conflict, over time, those radicals have gained a lot of strength. And that could result in a very dangerous situation for the U.S. 10, 20 years from now, when you have veterans from this Syrian jihad who are now pointing their guns at the U.S. or U.S. allies in the region.
We spoke with the lead spokesman for the rebels recently on this program, Khalid Saleh, and I want you to take a listen to something that he said.
Think about the ordinary Syrian who's living in the liberated areas. He could not care less about Syrian opposition and what they think and the disagreements amongst them. What he wants is he wants water, he wants food, he wants services, and that's what we've been telling the world. Help us provide services to the people.
So that sounds like asking for humanitarian aid. I mean, obviously, he in another part of the interview, he asked for arms and military aid as well. But are the Syrian rebels and the people that they are trying to help, are they getting the humanitarian need that they need?
There is humanitarian assistance, but when we're talking about humanitarian disaster on this scale, when we're talking about millions of internally displaced, we're talking about nearly 100,000 killed, all the humanitarian assistance the Syrians can get will not be enough. And you have to address the root of the problem, that the rebels can't hold on to enough territory because the regime is always pushing back, and they can kind of stay on the outskirts of a city and bomb it into oblivion through artillery and aircraft. So no one is going to be truly safe in Syria until this regime is pushed back or defeated. As long as the Syrian regime is alive and as long as Assad is the president of Syria, there is going to be more and more killing. There is no way to get around that. So we can address the humanitarian side as much as we want, and that's important. But if there isn't a real process through which the rebels are able to gain the military advantage against the Syrian regime, then the root of the problem isn't being addressed. And I should also note that I think one of the unfortunate aspects of this whole debate we've been having in the U.S. is that we talk about military intervention and diplomacy as two exclusive things, but actually, the only way Assad is going to make concessions or negotiate in even somewhat good faith is if there's a credible threat of military force. So I would actually argue that the threat of military intervention could actually help diplomacy succeed and not the other way around. If Assad doesn't feel he can lose, he's not going to give ground to the opposition.
Well, let me take that one step further, Shadi. Do we know for sure that the international community and the Obama administration want Assad gone?
Well, the U.S., France, Britain, Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia have all been very clear. They want Assad to go. Now, we can have a debate about whether that's what the U.S. really wants. I don't want to kind of, there are some conspiracy theories going around. It is true that the Obama administration has been worried about an outright rebel victory because they're very worried about the rise of extremists and the power vacuum that might result. So I think the U.S. position is hedging in some respect that, yes, they don't want Assad, but they're not sure they want the alternative either. But the real block in the international community is not the U.S. or France. It's the Russians and, to a lesser extent, the Chinese. So again, my question to those who oppose intervention is, your preferred policies have been tried. All of those efforts at a so-called political negotiation have failed miserably. So the question is, are we going to just keep on trying something that we all know deep down isn't going to work?
Shadi Hamid is the director of research for the Brookings Doha Center. He joined us via Skype from Doha. As always, thank you so much, Shadi.
Thanks so much for having me.
Just ahead, three black models shocked and outraged some New Yorkers by telling strangers they could touch their hair. And on the flip side, a teenager turned her Haitian great-grandmother's special hair pomade into big business when she was 9. Conversations about hairdos coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, we'll talk to the CEO of a six-figure company who launched a hair business when she was 9. But first, can I touch your hair? It's a question many black women say they're often asked, and sometimes people don't ask. They just reach out and grab it. It's a familiar topic here on Tell Me More, but a recent project in New York has started the conversation again. Antonia Opaya and her sister Abigail organized an event in Union Square in New York City. They asked three black models to stand side by side, holding signs that read, "You can touch my hair." They hoped people would take them up on the offer and then begin a conversation about the taboo of hair touching. The Opaya sisters join us now. Antonia is speaking to us from Paris. Welcome, Antonia.
Hello there.
And Abigail joins us from our New York City studios. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Antonia, this all began with an essay that you wrote for the Huffington Post called "Can I Touch Your Hair?" And, you know, this is a long-standing debate. What made you weigh in at this point?
Well, I guess because this year in January I launched a hair site, or a site dedicated to black hair, just because it is a topic that's rich with things to talk about. And I wanted to take this opportunity to talk about the whole hair touching phenomenon with a larger audience. Because most of the time, or prior to January, or prior to me having this site, I was really just having conversations about my encounters with strangers, with just my friends. And it's one thing to just have a conversation with your friends, and another thing to have it with a bigger forum.
Well, a bigger forum, I would assume, would include non-African Americans, non-black people who ask that question, can I touch your hair? And in many cases, they say, look, it's not, I'm not trying to be offensive. I'm just curious. My hair feels different and I want to see how yours feels. How do you explain to, say, a white person, a non-black person, why this is so emotional?
Well, it's a hard thing to explain, but I guess when it comes to hair, black hair is not just hair in America. There's so much history that we carry on our heads, so to speak. For the longest time, we've been told that our hair isn't acceptable in its natural state. So we were always encouraged to straighten it or wear weaves. And so now, especially, and there's been a few moments in time when we sort of, you know, put aside what everyone was telling us about our hair and did what we want, the Black Power movement, for example. And right now, there's currently a natural hair, some call it a renaissance or a movement happening, and it's doing a lot to reacquaint us with our hair. And so I guess to sum all of that history up in a nutshell, it's a difficult thing for any one person to explain, which is why I thought having a larger discussion about it could help sort of disseminate everything, the weight that our hair carries.
Which seems to have been the purpose behind I guess you'd call it an art exhibit or art project in New York. But here's Maya Chung, one of the hair models that stood in New York with the sign saying, "You can touch my hair." And here she is describing her motivation, at least behind participating in the event.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of misconceptions about black hair, a lot of questions that people have, curiosities. And I don't think there's anything wrong with addressing them. Just like, I mean, people have curiosities about everything. So we're just creating a forum for people to talk about it.
So there she is saying that there's curiosity and we're trying to create a forum for people to talk about it. But Abigail, there were people, African-American women especially, really offended, who felt as though this art project trivialized their feelings of exploitation when people touch their hair or ask to touch their hair. What's your response to the people who were outraged over the project?
Well, my response would be, you know, I think one of the main distinctions that we wanted to make with what we did versus what, you know, Sarah Bartman went through, for example, is the fact that
I should explain. Sarah Bartman was the South African woman in the 1800s who was exploited, displayed all over Europe.
Right, exactly. And some of the people had signs saying, "I'm not your Sarah Bartman." So what made what we did a little bit different is the fact that, you know, we did this on our own volition. You know, Sarah Bartman was duped, so to speak, into being put on display by white people. So I think, you know, they had seen images of the first event, they had seen the hashtag, and they didn't really understand the larger frame of the story that we were trying to tell. So I think they became very incensed about that and came out to really just add another layer to the dialogue, just to kind of let people know that this is not a free pass to let people, you know, just touch random women's hair. So that was their stance. And we kind of welcomed them because they were essentially saying the same things we were saying, just in a more direct form.
Well, let me have one of those people say those things directly. This is playwright Rada Blank, who showed up to protest the event. Let's listen to her comment.
"You're not inviting me into your home to talk to me about your money and your finances. Why do I have to then talk to you about how I style my hair and let you know how it feels so you can feel better about it? Not only can't you touch my hair, but I don't care what you think about it, and I don't care if you like it or not today."
And Antonia, how do you respond to that? I mean, first of all, I wonder if you were surprised by the strength of the protest.
I wasn't surprised by it. I understand where it comes from. We're a protective community, and we have reason to protect ourselves. Racism isn't something that happened in the past. It's something that continues to happen today. And the way it happens today is in a very sort of, it's not as visible as the way it happened in the past, which makes it more dangerous. So we're always, as a community, protecting ourselves from that kind of danger. So I understand where the protest came from. I think I took a couple of things away from the protest. One, I welcomed it. I wanted their voices to be heard because it's interesting. If you take a step back and look at what actually happened, you had women on one side saying, "You can touch my hair," and women on the other side saying, "You can't touch my hair," and not those exact words. But I think that if you look at that whole picture, it shows exactly where people stand. It shows that it's not, like, we all don't feel the same way about it. Rada has her opinion, and her opinion is completely valid, but it can't be applied to everyone. Not everyone sees it as someone stroking them like an animal. Some people actually welcome it, and that's one of the big takeaways that I got from the entire project, that the response to that question varies from woman to woman and even from moment to moment.
So you wanted to start a conversation with people who are not African American, perhaps, to help them understand the issue better. So let me allow you to do that. Let me play the role here of someone who says, look, I don't even know why you mention racism. It's not racism. I think your hair is beautiful. I've never felt anything like it. And I want to see, I want to understand what it's like. When you say racist, that makes me feel hurt. How do you respond to that?
Well, that's a hard one to respond to. But I guess the way I could respond to it is that if you're someone I don't know and you're putting me on the spot, it makes me feel self-aware and it makes me feel self-conscious. It makes me aware of my difference from you, even though I'm American too, in a time when I don't necessarily want to feel different. So I think there's a two-way sort of. This is a hard one to respond to. I think the underlying issue here is that America, we all go around touting, integration, and we're all equal and we're all the same. But there are these small moments that are happening in everyday lives that do a lot to make people aware of their race and aware of their differences. In some moments, I may be open to celebrating my differences and sharing those moments and sharing my differences with you and also learning about how you're different. Other moments, I don't necessarily want that responsibility. I may just want to go about my day and just be a normal person, be an American, not a Black American or a white American or someone that has hair that's different to you, because my hair isn't different to me. It's normal. It's something that I don't have to explain to myself or anyone else like me. So the fact that I have to explain it to you is something that I shouldn't necessarily have to do, because you don't have to explain your hair to me, because I know everything to know about your hair. The media tells me about your hair. The media doesn't necessarily expose my hair or my kind of hair to you.
You certainly had plenty to say about it in the end, didn't you? That's Antonia Opaya and Abigail Opaya, two sisters who held a public event in New York City called Touch My Hair, hoping to start a conversation. Antonia joined us from Paris. Abigail was in our New York City studios. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Next, we're going to talk to a young entrepreneur who's all about hair. Leanna Archer was just 9 years old when she launched her own line of natural hair care products. Her great-grandmother in Haiti had a special recipe for hair pomade, and Archer used that recipe to begin a line of oils, hair dressings, and conditioners. And now, at the ripe old age of 17, she handles more than 350 online orders a week and generates more than $100,000 in revenue every year. Leanna Archer joins us now to talk about her company and her experience as a teen entrepreneur, or what many people called a teenpreneur. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
As I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, your company kind of began organically because your friends started asking you what you used in your own hair, right?
Definitely. It was my friends, my neighbors, and just people I would cross paths with on a daily basis.
And at first you just made them a little bit of the same pomade that you made for yourself.
Well, actually, I just gave them, I guess you could say, samples from what grandma would send for us. I packaged them in Gerber jars and gave it out for free.
And then you realized that the desire for this pomade was strong enough to support a business.
Yeah, I mean, I had no intention of really selling it. I just knew that they wanted it, and I made it available for them. And next thing you know, they're showing up on my doorstep, throwing checks at me and asking me how much of it will get them. So from there, I decided to start the company.
And how did that transition happen? To go from, just making the odd batch and selling it to the person at your doorstep to where you are now? When did it become a real viable business?
I believe after I did my first couple of local newspaper interviews and I had my first magazine article, I was about 11 or 12 at the time. And the business started, acquiring customers not only from New York, but along the East Coast and then throughout the country and now the world.
Your products are completely 100% natural. They're made with things like avocado and natural oils. It's to a certain extent a coincidence that the same time that you were developing this hairline, there was a change coming among black women in the United States, that they were trying to return to more organic and natural hair treatments, stop chemically processing their hair. What exactly is behind that? What's motivating this return to natural hair care products?
The movement began pretty much because people became more educated about the products they were using in the hair and the kind of damages they might have, you know, depending on what kind of chemicals are used in it. People didn't really know how bad it was to perm your hair and then dye it and bleach it and color it all within the same time frame, and how it could affect them, not only their hair loss, but them, you know, health-wise. Now they educate themselves to, you know, sometimes natural is better.
Are your hair care products only for African-American women?
No, I actually sell my products in 80 different countries now. And surprisingly enough, Singapore, you know, one of the countries that you wouldn't think would need these kind of hair products, is probably one of my biggest, where a majority of my customers come from now.
Let me talk a little bit about the involvement of your family, but begin with your great-grandmother. This is her recipe that you began with.
Yes.
I understand she died 2 years ago, but she was there to watch your progress for quite
yes,
some time.
Was.
What did she think?
Up until the moment she passed away, she was always an active member of my company and helped me help supervise the work I was doing and make sure that I was doing it the way she taught me. And for the newer products, give her own input on what I should add, what I should take out. And she helped out a lot.
And I understand one of your employees is actually your father. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. My dad is my main employee, actually.
So you're his boss?
Yes, I am.
What is that like?
You know, he's the parent, you know, do chores, do homework kind of thing. And then once we step into my office, I'm the one in charge. I have fired him plenty of times and twice on national television, but he's one of those people that I just can't let go of.
So your family is Haitian, and all the ingredients for the products in your hair care products are from Haiti. And you've begun a foundation there. Tell me a little bit about your relationship to Haiti.
My first trip to Haiti was when I was 13, back in 2008. And going down on that trip was a culture shock for me. I became face-to-face with millions of kids in the streets, you know, not going to school, and pretty much just fending for themselves. And that was hard for me to take in, because the only difference I saw between me and them was that I had the opportunity to be born in a different setting. So I didn't want to leave without, you know, seeing if I can make a difference, and I did. So I started my the Leanna Archer Education Foundation. I mean, I have 200 kids under my foundation that I work with on a daily basis to provide food, shelter, and an education for them.
So I understand you just graduated from high school. Congratulations, first of all.
Thank you so much.
And you're headed off to college. Are you majoring in business, I assume?
No, actually, I'm majoring in political science. Not only do I have a knack for business, but also I have a knack to, you know, communicate and motivate. And I feel like eventually I might get tied into politics of some sort.
You might run for office.
Yeah, definitely.
Let me ask you, I'm sure there out there somewhere listening is some 9, 10, 11-year-old who has their own idea for a product or a service that they could start a business with. Mm-hmm. What would be the best advice you could give that kid?
Take advantage of the resources that are available for us. Fortunately, we grew up in a time where the internet has just about anything to offer. I didn't know anything about business. My family didn't know anything about business, but I see it as a learning process, and I'm continuously learning as I go. And just most of all, when you have an idea, stick to it, follow it through. Even if that's not what you're meant to be doing, it could lead you into something else that you become passionate about.
Like hair care products, eventually leading you to become a senator or president.
Definitely.
Leanna Archer is a 17-year-old CEO of Leanna's Inc. It's a company that specializes in natural hair care products. She joined us from our studios in New York. Thank you so much and good luck.
Thank you so much.
Up next, Emmy Thomas is a diagnosed sociopath. She says people like her have no empathy, guilt, or conscience. So what about the capacity for love?
you know, whatever it is that we feel affection, for me, it's, you know, maybe 70% gratitude, a little bit of adoration, a little bit of, if it's a romantic relationship, infatuation or sexual attraction.
Emmy Thomas talks about her new memoir, Confessions of a Sociopath. That's in a few minutes on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, we'll glimpse into the mind of a sociopath. We'll hear from an author who says she is a sociopath, but your assumptions about people like her might be completely off base. That's in a few minutes. First, we want to focus on a new exhibit coming to the National Archives in Washington, D.C. This exhibit tells the story of the battle for human rights in the United States, for women, for minorities, and for immigrants. The exhibit is called The Record of Rights. It opens later this year. Joining me now to talk about it is one of the museum curators, Jennifer Johnson. Thanks so much for being here with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is a big story. I mean, I would imagine editing the exhibit down is probably the biggest challenge, right?
Exactly. There are so many stories in our holdings to be told. And once we had the opportunity, with the generosity of David and Rubenstein with his donation, to make this new gallery, we knew we wanted to continue the story that we start in our rotunda, which is where the Declaration, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights are on display. And we wanted to take those documents, which are icons of human liberty, and tell the story of what happened after those were drafted and the Founding Fathers won.
So post-1776.
Post-1776, correct.
So tell me about one or two really, really cool pieces, artifacts that are going to be in this exhibit.
Some of my favorites are letters that we're going to have on display that were written by children, and they were written to President Truman in the late 1940s, basically voicing their concerns about segregation. One from 11-year-old named Jay Tagliaru states that he was very upset because he witnessed 51 children being denied entry into a Washington, D.C. hotel because four of the children were black. And he even drew pictures on the letter illustrating what he thought his vision of a better society could be. And he asked President Truman to do something about it.
What about something else? What is an artifact that gives us a different perspective on human rights in the country?
There, I would have to go to repatriation oaths. It's a little known chapter of our history that in 1907, Congress passed an act stating that women who married a foreigner would lose their citizenship status. Because at the time, women's citizenship was tied to marriage or to their father. And it wasn't until 1922 that that act was reversed. And before that, if women wanted to repatriate, which they could only do after death of their husband or through divorce, they had to fill out a form, which was called a repatriation oath, and pledge allegiance to the U.S. again.
What's your most recent piece that will be in the exhibit, do you think?
We definitely go up through President Obama signing the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. We have a photo in the exhibit of him signing that, and that was signed in January of 2009. I think the great thing about our records is that even though we have records dating from 1880s and from the early 20th century, the issues are still very much alive, and we still talk about them today.
But what story do you want someone to leave the exhibit with? I mean, you want them to be thinking what?
Just to start a dialogue about rights, and everyone has different views about what rights mean or what rights we should have. And so this exhibit kind of explores how citizens and even non-citizens, immigrants, have agitated or used the founding documents, the Constitution, and the words that are in that to push for rights that were guaranteed to them, but maybe not paved yet.
Do you answer that question of what is a right and what is a privilege?
We don't. We try not to. In fact, we just kind of put it out there for visitors to absorb and then let themselves ask themselves what they think about it. And in the very end, if they leave talking about what they saw and then connect that to anything that maybe they're seeing in today's news stories or events going on in the Supreme Court or rulings being talked about, then we think we've done our job. For instance, in our area called Yearning to Breathe Free, which talks about immigrant struggles over the last several decades and even centuries, we have a document called the Chinese Exclusion Act, which was passed in 1882. And then we have a document that is the deed for the Statue of Liberty, which was given in 1884. And those two documents are kind of the opposing ideals of what our country was striving for in immigration.
Guess you're poor, you're tired and hungry, but exactly. Not the Chinese.
So we kind of put those together just to let people think about these opposing ideals that we still talk about today and we're still debating today. We rights were debated before day one of this country's founding. The founding fathers struggled with this, and we continue to do so up to present day.
Jennifer Johnson, museum curator at the National Archives. She joined us in our Washington studios. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Now we take a peek behind doors that are usually closed to get a glimpse inside the mind of a sociopath. Now, I know as soon as I use that term, many people have already made some assumptions that sociopaths are criminals, killers, cruel, heartless. But author, blogger, and diagnosed sociopath Emmy Thomas wants to challenge the standing wisdom about antisocial personalities. She writes that most sociopaths are not incarcerated, that the silent majority of them live freely and anonymously. They're your neighbors, your colleagues, maybe even family members and loved ones. She admits they can be dangerous. They're hungry for power. They don't often feel guilt or remorse. But they're not inherently evil. And some are highly productive members of society. Emmy Thomas herself is an attorney, law professor, and Sunday school teacher. She's founder of the website sociopathworld.com, and her new memoir is titled Confessions of a Sociopath, A Life Spent Hidden in Plain Sight. And Emmy Thomas joins us now from NPR member station Mississippi Public Broadcasting. Welcome.
Thank you.
So let's talk about your decision to write this book in the first place and why you've written it using a pen name.
So the book came from the blog, and I started writing the blog because I was experiencing at the time a lot of bad things. I had just lost a job. I had just lost several relationships. And it wasn't the first time that something like this had happened to me, where my life seemed to just fall apart. And I thought, well, I can't keep doing this. Every few years, have my life just go kaput, I guess is what I would say. And so I thought, what is the common denominator here? It's me. There must be something that I'm doing that's causing this. So I started going to therapy, and therapy didn't really help that much. I didn't really get that much out of it. But I remembered through therapy a casual diagnosis that one of my coworkers had made years before. And I explained to her how I view the world and my ethical principles. And she said very nicely, you might consider the fact that you are a sociopath. So I looked it up and I saw the traits and it made sense. And it made sense in a way that nothing really before had. But at the time, everything was going well. And so I didn't really think much of it. It was just, you know, some interesting fact about myself. But then after I remembered it years later, I thought maybe there's something to this sociopathy thing. And maybe I should research it and see if this explains why I behave the way that I do.
Let's talk then about the definition of sociopath, because I think a lot of people interchange sociopath with psychopath. So what is the difference between the two, and what is their relationship to this new designation of antisocial personality?
Right. There's a lot of confusion about what exactly the terms mean and whether there's a distinction between sociopath and psychopath. Some researchers use it. And then a lot of people think that antisocial personality disorder has replaced both. And then there are other researchers who say that's not true. Sociopath is the term used by Hervey Cleckley in his Mask of Sanity book. And he's sort of the modern father, or the father of the modern concept of sociopathy.
So how does one recognize a sociopath? What distinguishes a sociopath from any other designation?
Some of the primary characteristics of a sociopath are the ones that you might notice are superficial charm. They can be very charismatic. They don't really get nervous. So if you see them in a car accident, everybody else is freaking out and they're just sitting there calmly dealing with problems. That's a trait. They tend to fail to conform to social norms, they might come off as a little bit of an independent thinker, or they might be committing crimes, depending on who they are. They have a facility with lying. Well, they lie frequently, obviously, to cover up certain aspects of themselves, identifying aspects or things that would indicate that they're a sociopath. Probably the biggest characteristic of a sociopath is their lack of empathy. They don't really have the meaningful emotional worlds, inner worlds that most people have. And perhaps because of that, they can't really imagine or feel the emotional worlds of other people. It's very foreign to them. And they don't have a conscience. They don't really feel guilt. And our classic conception of what a conscience is feelings of guilt. I think you do something and then you feel guilty afterwards, and we call that conscience. So because sociopaths don't feel guilt or don't really give meaning or context to feelings of guilt, then they don't have this innate conscience that most people have.
So, okay, so let's go back to why you used a pen name. There are very specific details about your family, about your work, your friends, that I have to imagine that anybody who knows you in real life will know that this is you writing.
Definitely. So while I was writing the blog, I felt like I was living a little bit of a double life. I had my normal life where I went to work, and then I had the other life where I was very honest with my motivations on the blog, and I interacted with people in a very authentic way. And I started liking the second life better. And I started thinking, well, maybe there's a possibility that I can start being more authentic in my real life. So when I was deciding what to include in the book, I made the choice to be more authentic, to be more who exactly I am, with the knowledge that people would know who I am, but thinking that that was a good thing, that I would like to be more open with the people that already know me particularly. But I use the pen name because strangers, other random people, it's possibly dangerous. There's a huge stigma against sociopaths. And I wanted to protect my family a little bit as well. I have little relatives who share my last name, and they've done nothing really to bring any sort of notoriety to themselves.
You write in your book about how those things which could be perceived as weaknesses or strikes against a person can actually help you in your professional life, in relationships. Sometimes some of these very traits that are decried in sociopaths can be useful.
Oh, definitely. I think they can be useful. They're very good at cutting to the weakness of a situation, whether it's, you know, what am I doing wrong here? Let me help you. Here's what you're doing wrong.
Is it because the emotion is taken out of it?
It must be. I think emotion, when you live in a world that's so complex, it would be sort of like being colorblind. If you took color out of things, then you would perceive things differently. Things that you otherwise would have largely ignored maybe become more important to you because there's not as much going on.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the new memoir, Confessions of a Sociopath, with author M.E. Thomas, which is a pen name. I want to maybe risk being a little Freudian here and go back to your childhood. Early on in the book, you say, you know, I didn't have a bad childhood. I had a perfectly normal childhood. You can't blame me being a sociopath on that. But let me read an excerpt from the book itself. This is where you're talking about your father, who you describe as violent and shaming, and your mother described as indifferent, sometimes hysterically. And you write this: I never doubted their love for me, but their love was inconstant. It was sometimes very ugly. It didn't prevent me from harm, rather it often caused me harm. The more they felt secure in their love for me, the less they seemed prompted actually to look after my well-being. I learned a lot from my parents. I learned to limit the emotional effect other people could have on me. I learned to be self-sufficient. They taught me that love is exceedingly unreliable, and so I have never relied on it. You describe an incident in which your father punches a hole in the bathroom door large enough to put his face through, and another in which your mother and father take you and your brother to the park and then drive away. That, to me, doesn't seem like an unbad childhood. That seems like a kind of negative childhood.
I do think that it's negative. I think I say in the book it was an unremarkable childhood, and I think that's just acknowledging that those are bad things, but they're not so unusual, unfortunately. I think a lot of people experience those sorts of bad things, but they don't grow up to be sociopaths. So it was more a point of, it's not just the bad things. And maybe if I were treated more or less horrifically, it would have mattered and affected the extent to which my sociopathy manifests itself. But I think that without that genetic component, bad things can happen to people and they don't turn out bad. Nobody else in my family is a sociopath. My siblings basically experienced the same upbringing, but I'm the only one that's this way.
And yet there's a bit of a warning in this memoir for other people in dealing with sociopaths, that sociopaths to a certain extent see other people in terms of what use they can be to you,
right? How they could be used to gain your own ends. I remember one point where you're describing charging your brother money to play the games that he wants to play. So, I mean, that's a bit of a warning to your readers, right?
Definitely. I think I don't want to whitewash sociopathy at all. When I talk about these different issues, I just want to sort of clarify things. I think people jump to particular conclusions. But it is true, sociopaths do see other people largely in terms of what they can provide to the sociopath. And I think it's largely because they don't feel the same sorts of emotional connections. They don't feel empathy. So take that stuff away, and what are you forced to think about people? You're going to interact with people no matter what. Everybody has a mother and a father. You're still going to value people because people are valuable. People are interesting. People are very complex. They can be very helpful. They're useful. Nobody wants to live a life without people. That's a worse life, no matter if you're a sociopath or not.
So a sociopath, you and others like you, are capable of having fulfilling and loving relationships?
Definitely fulfilling. And I think loving, we feel a love. You know, whatever it is that we feel, affection, for me, it's, you know, maybe 70% gratitude, a little bit of adoration, a little bit of, if it's a romantic relationship, infatuation or sexual attraction. I think a complex emotion like love is made up of all sorts of little emotions. And our particular cocktail of love is going to look or feel different to us, but it's still there.
You know, the book doesn't appear to be aimed at other sociopaths. I mean, you're very unflinching in describing your own thought processes, even when they're not necessarily flattering to you, even when they're sometimes harsh. And that, to me, reads like it's meant for someone like me, someone who perhaps needs to understand sociopaths better. I wonder if the point of the book is to educate people or clarify, as you say, what are you hoping to teach people?
I guess I'm not really hoping to teach people so much as start a conversation. I think that there really has been so little research done about sociopaths. And the common wisdom now is that they're untreatable and that, you know, sociopathy is basically synonymous with evil. So I just wanted to sort of provide some sort of explanation. You know, statistically, everybody has interacted with a sociopath at one point. But the fact that most people can't identify who a sociopath is or remember those sorts of interactions suggests to me that it couldn't have been that bad of an interaction, right? Most people interact with sociopaths in positive ways and don't realize it. And it's only when we catch them and they're in prison and we have gone through this lengthy trial to point out all the bad things that they've done that we start thinking sociopaths are bad. But I think whenever you collect only criminals, and that's what you're basing the diagnosis, or that's what you're basing people's understanding about a category like sociopathy on, then it's going to not be accurate. It's not going to reflect the diversity that exists within sociopathy.
Well, if this is the beginning of a conversation, it's certainly an interesting one. The new memoir is called Confessions of a Sociopath. It's written by M.E. Thomas. That's a pen name of the author. She's also an attorney and law professor. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We'll talk more tomorrow.